Of course, strictly speaking, I was not the only person to have witnessed World War III. A small number of senior military personnel in the NATO and Israeli and Iranian high commands, as well as President Trump, Prime Minister Netanyahu, Grand Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and their aides, and the military officers who decrypted the nuclear launch codes and sent the missiles on their way into unknown regions of the Arab Sea, were well aware that war had been declared and that a ceasefire agreed 4 minutes later. But I have yet to meet a member of the ordinary public who has heard of World War III. Whenever I refer to the war, people stare at me with incredulity. Several parents have withdrawn their children from the pediatric clinic, obviously concerned for my mental stability. Only yesterday, one mother, to whom I casually mentioned the war, later telephoned my wife to express her anxieties. But Andreza, like everyone else, has forgotten the war, even though I've played video recordings to her of the Fox, MSNBC, and CNN newscasts of the 23rd of June, which actually announced that World War III had begun. Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast. It's the end of June 2025, and this is our end-of-month episode. I'm Alex Hokuli, and I'm with fellow Bunga boy George Hoare. We're basically two guys that have been podcasting for so long and so hard that we don't know what the fuck we're doing. Hello, George.
Hey. Yeah, podcasting here from the bunker. But yeah, I did like your creative opening to the episode.
Yeah, that to J.G. Ballard's The Secret History of World War III, adapted for our present purposes in 2025. So I don't know if you've been monitoring the situation, George, but let me just outline for listeners what we're going to be talking about today. Firstly, a bit of context on the Iran war that didn't really happen, but sort of is still happening, but might yet happen, but also maybe not. The origins of sane washing. We'll move on then to U.S. political polarization between Jacksonian or Jeffersonian on the one hand and Hamiltonian on the other hand, the decline of left versus right and what all this means. We'll briefly preview what's coming up next month. And then, of course, the latter half of this episode dedicated to letters to the editor, where we deal with your questions and comments from the past month. Lots of juicy ones. Thank you, as always, for sending them in. Looking forward to getting onto that. But before that, I guess I need to ask George, how's the neck? You feeling that whiplash? You're monitoring the situation, as the phrase now goes, over the past few weeks. I should note that we're recording this on the 25th of June, in case, you know, the world has blown up and you're listening to this from your bunker, having survived.
Yeah, if so, good luck to you. No, the Iran war did not take place, I think, is the official line, the Baudrillardian line. No, it's yeah, I do. I like Trump's chutzpah in the whole. In the face of, you know, potentially globally catastrophic events, he just tells people off and tells people that they don't know what they're doing because they've been doing it for too long and too hard. And it's like, well, yeah, sometimes you just need an angry American guy to shout at people and get the situation resolved.
Exactly. Well, you know, he's like wrong 98% of the time, but that 2%, he really, really nails it home. But yeah, it's all just like the old mysterious Frenchman prophesized, particularly Baudrillard, who you mentioned, and Guy Debord to a certain extent as well, because there's a question about whether this 12-hour war was actually just pure spectacle. I haven't made my mind up about it. So we were actually going in this episode to talk about the ins and outs of the US/Israeli and Iran war, but that's mercifully on hold for now, though, of course, by the time this reaches your ears, maybe not. Anyway, congrats everyone for the courage, stamina, and intelligence to have forgotten what no one other than the U.S. president is calling this 12-day war, which has ended in 12 hours, but then not because the Israelis continued, and then Mr. Trump had harsh words for them. So a lot of the discussion has concerned, obviously, Trump, to a certain extent, his people, and even his supporters' apparent pivot from an isolationist America First position to a new 2000-style neocon one. J.D. Vance even announced, I don't know if you saw this, George, he announced, "I empathize with Americans who are exhausted after 25 years of foreign entanglements in the Middle East. I understand the concern, but the difference is that back then we had dumb presidents." If that isn't techno-populism, I don't know what is. That's perfect. It's like, so now you have the smart, most qualified leader to implement the correct solution, do war properly.
Yeah, do war quickly, get it over and done with in 12 hours, bam.
Others were concerned to note that unlike the rush to war in Iraq, there was little attempt to manufacture consent for another regime change and nation-building experiment in Iran. As someone joked on X, they didn't even have the courtesy to false flag us this time. This is obviously a step change in Western-led savagery, to be understood in tandem with support for Israeli slaughter and carnage in Gaza. Elites don't even have to concern themselves with making a show of tending to domestic constituencies anymore. Of course, viewed from the light of today, on the 25th of June, we can say, actually, no, this was all part of Trump's grand plan. It was the art of the deal. Play brinkmanship, threaten war and regime change, and then all sides can back down. There was no manufacturing consent because there was never going to be full-scale U.S. attack on Iran. This shows that actually domestic constituencies are important and relevant because Trump was elected, in part, on an isolationist platform. They dare not even have tried manufacture consent because they know that wouldn't fly. The MAGA proposition is still intact. I think it's quite obvious. I mean, I'm satirizing these positions because neither of these positions really hold. I think both of them seem like ex post facto justification. The picture's a lot more confused. So yes, Trump speaks more harshly to the Israelis than past US presidents, but he's hardly reined in Netanyahu. Trump marks a break with the neocon tendency in the Republican Party, yes, but he's hardly anti-war or against the projection of US power. So I actually think, kind of reflecting on the bizarre nature of the past 2 weeks, I suppose, is that to read too much strategy into what we're seeing would be to mistake what is actually an assemblage of clever tactics and perhaps even internal conflicts at the top of the US state manifesting themselves, and to misunderstand that as strategy. And to do that would be to engage in something that I learned is called sane washing. More on that in just a second. But we did discuss this notion in an episode on Trump's tariffs, which I recorded with Lee Jones back in April. There's a temptation to say that everything that Trump does is crazy, reactive, senseless. And there's an opposing tendency to say it's all part of a grand strategy, that he knows what he's doing, he's in control. To paraphrase Lee Jones and his take on the matter, which regards tariffs, but it probably applies just as much to this question of the Iran war, is that some claim to discern a master plan at work, but then anybody discussing it as such inevitably gets denounced by the first camp as sane washing Trump. But if a detailed grand strategy seems implausible, nor does it seem wise to retreat to an account based purely on irrationality. Corey Robin suggested on this podcast and elsewhere that with Trump, anything is possible, so everything is plausible, which is a nice line, but maybe that doesn't provide us with the sort of analytical traction and political guidance we need at this moment. So the truth is somewhere in between, and I think we will have to apply that analysis when we come to discussing Iran later this month. George?
Yeah, I guess one of the problems with saying that anything is possible, so everything is plausible, is it doesn't, that can be used at any point in time. It doesn't enable you to produce a model that could predict what will come next. And there must be, I think, maybe I'm in the sane washing camp, but there must be a model of political action that can be applied to contemporary American politics, including America's president. You know, what are the political alliances and constraints that Trump and Trumpism operates under? What's the constituent parts of the worldview? What are the constituencies that have to be appealed to? And yeah, maybe there is a, what you could call an emergent strategy, which is sometimes a phrase used to describe a master plan that comes out of or can be inferred from a set of more instinctual or seemingly unconnected tactics or actions. But I think the Trump derangement syndrome is much less with Trump 2.0 than it is Trump 1.0. But the goal still has to be to explain and respond to political changes and the challenges of explaining exactly how Trump is operating, I guess, is you know, perhaps greater than Biden, but equally, you know, with Joe Biden, what was going on there? There is a
what was going on there? Yeah, no,
you know, and I don't think people, Well, maybe people were accused of seine washing or compos mentis washing or whatever the right washing would have been at that point in time. Yeah, I mean, I think particularly with this, I'm kind of glad that we are not doing an episode entirely on the kind of Iran war, because it seems very much too early to tell what really, whether this has worked, Trump's kind of spectacular tactics, and also what will happen in the longer term. But
we're not going to do the predictions, and in fact I should say it's not that we're not discussing Iran like ever, it's that we're doing a dedicated episode on Iran in the coming weeks at the start of July with Eskander Sadeghi. He's a specialist on Iran and its international relations, so we'll be looking at the U.S. encirclement of Iran, whether a war is likely, what the strategies and end games of the various parties look like, and indeed how this is playing out domestically within the Islamic Republic. So I'm really looking forward to doing that will be coming to you, listener, in the next week or two. I mean, just two things on what George has said. One, I'm not sure if there's a model for Trump, is because precisely a model suggests laws and regular mechanisms of action which can be predicted, and I don't think it's that. I mean, there's obviously a lot of chaos in the policy making, a lot of internal contradictions which are reflected by different interests and different ideological camps within his administration, and there's different ways to characterize this, which we're going to get onto, actually, at least one way of talking about it and why that may or may not be correct. But I want to just quote from a piece which came out, I think, today by Sohrab Amari in Unheard, "Did Iran Win the 12-Day War?" And you can read that for yourself. But just the concluding point, I think, is relevant to what we've just been saying here. "Maybe American support isn't all that necessary anymore to Israel. Maybe Trump's permanent ceasefire will hold. Maybe Washington and Tehran will make a deal that will satisfy hardliners in Washington and Jerusalem. Then again, it's telling that American hawks are already complaining about the ceasefire and insisting that nothing short of regime change will do. But younger cohorts of security professionals, Republican and Democrat, have had more than enough. Their dissatisfaction is likely to crystallize into a hard determination to avert a repeat of the 12-day war gambit. None of Israel's spectacular battlefield and intelligence victories, I suspect, can compensate for this generational political loss." I think that's good because it identifies a clear tendency in American foreign policymaking and the shifting strength and weaknesses of alliances, and particularly with regard to Israel, which I think, as many people have pointed out, is due to weaken because younger cohorts are no longer so wedded to Israel at all costs, right? Like, as it's been characterized, I think, kind of jokingly, like America first, but first Israel, or, you know, America first, and that's why we have to support Israel. So I think these things are changing, and that's a good way to characterize a tendency, but which leaves open a lot of short-term possibility of things spiraling in different direction because of different, the kind of constellation of different interests and a president whose modus operandi is, again, tactics over strategy. So I just want to briefly touch on what the seine washing idea is, because we had a listener, Eli. I actually asked him. No, it's not Eli S. It's L-E-S. I was mispronouncing it. Anyway, he writes in to say that seine washing comes from a 2022 Substack post by someone called Inverse Florida, which my reading of it and reading of that Substack seems to be that they're like a former leftist, but now self-declared neoliberal, interested in criticizing radical subcultures. So kind of a reformed leftist, but now neoliberal centrist, anti-radical. Anyway, but the piece is kind of interesting, and I'm just going to try to summarize from that piece, because I wasn't familiar with this term, and its origin actually surprised me a little bit. So in this post, Inverse Florida discusses the politics around defund the police as a slogan and a demand, and how there's an overlap between political milieus. So, to quote from it, "The social network overlap of leftists with mainstream progressives creates an incentive for mainstream progressives to quote-unquote seinewash leftist slogans or activism. Rhetoric will spread so readily from hard leftist spaces to mainstream progressives because it spreads through the social justice warrior space, and it spreads by the same dynamic of implication of strong consensus, of a long history of established truth, and an implication of guilt if you can't get with a program." I'm sure everyone's encountered this before. So, well, you know, it's 2025 now. You must, you know, such and such, as if it were self-evident and everyone must agree, although it's quite a radical demand, right? So that's how defund the police can be spread up through hard leftist spaces into mainstream progressive spaces. Defund the police, or indeed, you know, abolish the police, and various kind of anti-carceral policies around that, which are quite radical statements. But, you know, wherever you find yourself on the matter, I think it's utopian in the kind of classical sense of the word. But nevertheless, you know, these are things which you would expect, if you want to advance them, you have to understand that they're quite radical demands, but they're often presented, particularly as they enter mainstream kind of centrist discourse, as kind of self-evident things, which everybody's got to get on board with. Otherwise, you're, you know, bad thing, bigoted in some way. What happens is that people go, well, obviously the arguments that people are making are insane and not what people actually believe or mean. But think of them as saying more reasonable thing. If you're sane washing, you won't let people make their argument for themselves. You'll do it for them, and you'll do it often, presenting the most reasonable version of what the people in your social group are pressuring you to believe, so that you can still do activism properly without surrendering the beliefs that you'd be guilty for not having. Right? So there's a little bit of a push and pull, a kind of concealment of some elements of a more radical position, and a spelling out of the kind of more moderate or reasonable version of that. It's a kind of a version of the Mott and Bailey argument as well. This is something that the right does as well. So conservatives have sane washed the groomer discourse, for instance, right? That there's like groomer predators everywhere, blah, blah, blah. And then kind of more mainstream right-wing figures go, no, what they actually mean is such and such, you know, and it's actually something far more reasonable. Have you encountered this? And do you think, how do you think also this relates to the Trump question, right? Of how people, quote unquote, sane wash Trump?
Yeah, I mean, long-time listeners will know that we had a rather heated discussion about Mott and Bailey arguments, not really about anything more than the construction of early modern, late medieval kind of fortifications and castles. I find this an unwieldy term, and it's not one that I think I would ever use against somebody. So the idea is that more kind of politically central people have, like, ventriloquized more radical people in a way that benefits them, right? Is that what? Because I guess to kind of talk about like greenwashing, that's when my understanding of it is when for example, an evil corporation, which is, you know, pumping oil into the rivers, that would be the kind of the Captain Planet version. But more realistically, particularly in Britain today, it's just dumping sewage into the rivers. They have some token initiatives that allow them to portray themselves in a very environmentally friendly way. But here the same washer and the same washee, if that's the right word, are different people, right? So it's, yeah, you're doing it on behalf of someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I guess there's two ways to see this. One is that the kind of center, because it would be like, insofar as center means what is moderate, accepted, reasonable opinion, which, as we know, centrism is often not very moderate or reasonable at all. But anyway, assuming that the center kind of in some way is a more moderated version of what its relative wings would be like, it kind of, the one version is like it goes and takes, for example, something some nutty far left sect says, some like Maoist or black nationalist or whatever, is like, we should kill all white people and have China take over America or something. And the sane washing would be to say, well, okay, there's all these people on the street saying that, but of course they don't literally mean that. What they mean is that there should be a counterbalance to US power and that racism is a serious problem in American society, right? So that you've just kind of sane washed this thing, which is quote unquote insane. But I think that's, what I think is neat about this Substack is that it explains how, you know, these kind of things which are quite extreme and come from small leftist milieus enter kind of mainstream, soft, progressive, center-left discourses and communications, right? And you know, often kind of, I know people on this podcast have made the point like, oh, they're the same thing. They're all, you know, they're all wokes or whatever. But it's like, no, but they're actually different milieus, right? And there's a way that one thing passes into the other. And again, this the same most likely happens on the right, though I'm less familiar with it. But I think this is kind of different to the way that sane washing is used when discussing Trump, right? And because of the question of strategy and tactics, because what we were discussing regarding the tariffs and brought up again now with regard to the Iran war is that what you're seeing is like quite chaotic, undoubtedly, indisputably chaotic actions, which push one way and then the other, and which are a series of tactics, but it's not clear whether they amount to a proper strategy because there's so many loose ends and unpredictable moments, which if they had gone some in a different direction, you know, would have prevented the next step in the tactics from being implemented. So it's definitely chaotic. And so people go then and go, yes, but it's all part of a grand strategy. Is sane washing, not in the sense of like making something more moderate, but making something more coherent. And I guess that's the difference in the application of it. But anyway, I don't know if I'll be using the term sane washing at any rate, but I just found it interesting to be put onto the history of the term. So one final point before we get on to the next matters at hand, I wanted to refer back to it's the penultimate episode of June, the one just before this, which we did with James Pogue. In that, George and I, speaking to the journalist James Pogue, we talked mainly about revolt by rural Western Americans against the federal state. But we also, towards the end of that, discussed how to conceive of political polarization in the U.S. Pogue was of the opinion that it's, I guess, Jacksonian America. And I think, you know, George, you made points along these lines and kind of reinterpreting what Pogue was saying, that Jacksonian America of limited government, state rights, agrarianism, populism, and nationalism can be put up against a different vision, which is much more centralized, urban, developmentalist, and progressive in the classical sense. This all builds on Walter Russell Mead's conception of the four schoolmasters of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, this is specifically about foreign policy, and it's kind of different iterations and versions when it comes to domestic politics. But it's actually, they're neat ways of mediating the kind of national and the foreign policy. But they're, you know, Hamiltonianism, Wilsonianism, Jeffersonianism, and Jacksonianism. And I think probably most frequently encountered is Hamiltonian versus Jeffersonian as a way of conceiving of U.S. politics, which I think particularly captures the spectrum from the centralization versus decentralization, right? How much you want the kind of center to be making decisions and how much you want to be kind of disaggregated and to kind of, you know, have some like subsidiarity in political decision making and policy. And what was interesting, I thought, was that, you know, we recorded that as this whole Iran stuff was going on. I mean, we recorded it like last week, you know, from, I think it was exactly a week ago. So Wednesday, the 18th of June. And it quite clearly expressed those differing interpretations. So, I mean, just to cite one example here, I saw one kind of fairly senior foreign policy, U.S. policy wonk, reflecting on Trump's threat of war on the 21st of June as quote-unquote peak Jacksonianism. It was the targeted use of overwhelming military force for a specific aim while signaling an intent to avoid further entanglement. In response to that, a senior editor at American Conservative, which is a sort of paleocon mag, replied saying, no, Jacksonianism is about, yes, overwhelming military force to neutralize threats to U.S. security. But Trump's brinkmanship with Iran is not that at all, right? Because it didn't really neutralize threats to U.S. security, right? It's much more about projection of American power abroad, somewhere very far away. So anyway, I don't know if you find these kind of terms useful, or if they're things you use in kind of understanding American foreign policy.
No, I think an American domestic policy as well. It definitely got me thinking in the week since we recorded that episode that one good book about, and I guess it's about European politics, is previous guest of on this podcast that here, Hazara Singh's book on political traditions. And it's, you know, it's about socialism, liberalism, conservatism, talks about republicanism in France and a few other things. And it's, you know, very historical and a great read. It must be from the mid-90s, so maybe it's been updated since then. But anyway, and it just got me thinking that, you know, the way that James described all these things, it was the importance of land and the frontier liberalism. I mean, this is something which I don't think makes that much sense out of the context of the US, but like this Hamiltonianism, Jacksonianism, Jeffersonianism, like as political traditions within the US, I think they are starting to seem more important or more relevant. And I don't know if that's a sign of kind of ideological crystallization around some kind of the politics of land and land disputes. Maybe I'm reading too much into the particular episode that we did and seeing it in other kind of aspects of American politics, but it does seem to me like there is something to be gained from that kind of historical. I know the listeners might be bored of the US by now, but it does seem like American politics is more interesting, actually, I would say, than it has been, because there does seem to be, and it's coming from the right, some looking back into what are the kind of political traditions that should animate domestic politics and should kind of shape these kind of characteristic responses to conflicts over land. So yeah, I do find it useful, and I wish that I knew a little bit more about those four figures. I think I know probably more about some of them than others, but this is, you know, the conversation to continue in this direction perhaps.
Yeah, I don't think there's, you know, land conflicts are particularly central in the US. You know, I mean, they're central maybe to certain people, but it's a bit like saying, you know, whatever. You could pick any kind of element of politics. You'll find some people interested in it, but it doesn't mean that it kind of shapes politics. Because, you know, if you think of land, it's probably actually, you know, house building is far more important and relevant than, you know, you know, having cattle on the land, right? And who controls that sort of land. My kind of reading is that, let me put it this way. So Pogue went kind of further than I think even what we've kind of relayed here in saying that the divisions on the right, specifically on the right, are of an ethnic character between heritage Americans, of which Steve Bannon is clearly the kind of spokesperson, and they draw their history back to Scots-Irish migration to the U.S., versus kind of other ethnicities, particularly, you know, shady, deracinated Jews with no connection to the land, cosmopolitans who want to draw the U.S. into foreign entanglements. And I don't know if that at least, you know, maybe describes in a certain way divisions on the right today amongst kind of top policymakers and interests, but I don't think it explains it, right? Which is a different thing. You can describe something, which is like, tell me what colors it is, but it doesn't explain why they move the way they move and what they're doing. I also think that this kind of division between heritage Americans and more recent immigrants, or indeed, you know, Jacksonianism or Jeffersonianism on the one hand versus Hamiltonianism, you know, I don't think that's, I think it's wrong to be like, well, this is what there used to be, and now it's reaffirming itself. I think it's all too much of a reach into a deep past. If US polarities today don't really map onto left versus right so neatly, I don't think it's because of like some longstanding US exceptionalism where, okay, the US never really conformed to the European polarity of socialist urban working class versus, on the other hand, urban bourgeois in alliance with aristocratic rural landowners and farmers. And the reason for that is that like left versus right is in crisis everywhere. I mean, that depiction there doesn't describe European politics anymore either, really. As we well know, you know, class realignment is a major factor almost everywhere in the world. The culturalization of politics has also reordered the pieces, and in some cases probably even led to a kind of inversion of left versus right relative to their historical meanings. And the US isn't an exception to that at all. It participates of the same universal tendencies of breakdown of kind of modern politics as anywhere else does. So the idea that the US is now like returning to its true nature or something, its true nature, which was like set up in the 19th century effectively, I think that's misguided. You know, it's like what we're seeing is a breakdown of the 20th century, not the return somehow to the 19th century. Like the defeat of socialism in the 1980s globally, and you know, if you want to go further back to the 1930s even, and now the crumbling of liberalism means that the politics which used to polarize of basically socialism and left liberalism versus, you know, conservatism and right liberalism, that's completely broken down. So for me, you're getting like reactionary ideas all over the right, whether they're Nietzschean or religious, and a bunch of reactionary ideas on the left as well, only interspersed with a few Enlightenment ideals, even if they're corrupted. So I think that's more of a description of politics today than these terms relative to kind of founding fathers or early American presidents.
Yeah, I guess I was kind of, as you were talking there, thinking about the explanation of Trump one that we kind of gave on this podcast. Obviously, we started recording it only after Trump had been elected back in 2016, and so we didn't have a chance to kind of predict it or otherwise. But one of the, I think, I refer to this book all the time, but We're Still Here by Jennifer Silver. I just think that was a really good account of some of the sources of Trump's appeal, which was at least in, you know, the working class areas that, or the people in these areas that Jennifer Silver spoke to, it was largely disaffection with the Democrats and the feeling that, you know, there was a feeling of betrayal, or this is the way that Steve Hall and his co-authors have talked about kind of being people in Britain being let down by the Labour Party and then looking for kind of right-wing alternatives. But it seems like, and so this is obviously very far from the, you know, it's fascism, it's the far right kind of liberal response. But when it comes to Trump too, I think there is a question of like, what is the appeal of MAGA? What is the kind of, beyond the kind of, you know, Trump as an individual and his charisma and his like just banter or whatever, he's bantering with the Israelis and the Iranians and saying that they don't know what the fuck they're doing. And that's, you know, an image of America perhaps. But some of the things that James Polk said about, you know, making America great again for a lot of people is making America heritage again. There was, you know, that is an area of, that I just, it just kind of resonated, and it made me think that there is maybe something to this particular construction of what a great America would look like, a particular historical period that is being appealed to here. But I do take your point that there is a, like,
but actually, I think there's a difference between like national greatness and then the much more libertarian ideals of the people Pogue was talking about, right? Like, make America great is like mid 20th century America, right? It's kind of the 1950s, 1960s. You know,
no,
and,
this
and
is
not
this
kind
is...
of 19th century homesteader. I mean, all I'm pointing at is that there's a lot of different things going on here. I don't think it's like straightforward. And I think at the base level of people of support, not even supporters, but voters, right, which is less than supporters, politics is much more simple, which is to say no one really cares about politics. And to a certain extent, they do care. It's a little bit like, well, these people have betrayed us, or they haven't done anything for us, so I'm going to go for the other guy, right? I mean,
yeah. I guess I'd kind of previously assumed that making America great again was a kind of hidden or coded social democratic sort of like, let's go back to the 50s and where we made shit, and kind of, you know, maybe there was a more conservative gender relations, but there was this kind of forward movement towards ever greater greatness for America. But actually, maybe it's not about that. Maybe the homesteaders play a more important part than I'd previously considered. I'd always thought this was relatively fringe because it certainly is here, but maybe in America it does have a resonance, and that kind of don't tread on me, or like that kind of element of like, fuck, government can fuck off and just leave us alone. That sort of libertarianism is very different to the, but you can see why it could align with the kind of tech libertarianism, which is like, let's just get rid of people and there should be no rules of any sort ever.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. Or indeed align in a different direction to kind of a nativist and even racist expression or whatever. These things kind of spiral off in different directions. But, you know, as you hint, what's going on the right, this seems a lot more intellectually interesting, at least to observe, than what's going on the left. But that's for another time. Just to tell you what's coming up next month, very exciting month of July, we have our 500th anniversary episode, The World in 2025. More on that soon.
Sorry, just to interrupt. Yeah. It's our 500th episode. It's not our 500th anniversary episode. We haven't been going for 500 years. That makes it sound like it's the whatever Bunga Reich, the never-ending... But yeah,
because anniversary suggests years. You're right. It's true. It's our 500th episode commemorations. Yes, commemorative episode.
There'll be a procession. There'll be a flyby.
Yeah, invented traditions. Yeah, we will, as already mentioned, have Eskander Sadeghi on to talk about Iran. We also will be returned to the question of Tezcriel. You don't know what that means? Maybe it's a stupid acronym. But it's about rationalism and ideologies associated with tech, the coming of AI, and so on. We are talking to James Hughes from the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and Ellie Senesh about that, which is in part a response to an episode we had back in May, which was where Alex Gendler presented his critique of quote-unquote rationalism. We will also have British writer Lamorna Ash on how young people search for meaning in an era of individualism and dwindling community spaces is leading some to find it in Christianity, kind of return to faith, what that means. How individualized is that itself? I'm really excited about that episode and to find out about that. And then finally, what's the difference between shame and guilt? Which one's better? Do we need one and not the other? Taylor Hines from Damage Magazine is going to tell us why we're all wrong, really. And we should feel guilty and ashamed about being wrong. But we don't know what yet about, which is actually leaving me pretty anxious. So hopefully that episode comes soon and I can find the answers. Right, letters to the editor time. Let's go. Firstly, Anders William Berg writes in reference to no episode in particular, but since you've been talking about gaming a bit on the show, I thought I'd send you an article I wrote about the rise of wokeness in Dungeons and Dragons, which George had the courtesy to read because that's really not my bag. But anyway, Anders explains that this is supposed to be a sort of case study on woke cultural production, whether wokeness is over or not, which is something that we've discussed plenty on the show, and which indeed he asks himself in the article. For him, it all depends on what one means by wokeness, whether it's a literary style, a set of identitarian political policies, a way of the state administering multiculturalism and gender politics, or something else entirely. Anders is skeptical of wokeness being over, at least in the sense that people depending on it to reproduce themselves as a class haven't actually gone anywhere. George.
Yeah, so this is an interesting article that we'll link to in the show notes. So yeah, it seems to me like D&D is becoming more and more popular. I met somebody at a dinner party who, you know, in their 20s, who's like plays D&D with AI, like does a one person game, which
I was hoping that I was like, oh, people are good are getting together playing games. I'm good with that, even if the content of them doesn't appeal to me. But with the AI, no.
Yeah, I was like, wow, this is making me feel out of touch for sure. But no, I think so. Yeah, there's a couple of things that Anders quotes from Malcolm Chayne, who's also previous guest on this podcast, that wokeness is a sorting mechanism and also functions as an argument for increased managerial intervention. And I think both of these two things are really clearly illustrated by, so I'm not a historian of this of this game, but my basic understanding of D&D is that it, you know, is basically some guy who just wrote, very inspired by Lord of the Rings, just wrote this rule book, and it was like, yeah, just photocopy it, and you know, you don't need any equipment. And now it's been bought by a big company called Wizards of the Coast. And essentially they've marketized it. They've made money out of it. Things like Stranger Things and the TV show now have D&D I think increasingly culturally mainstream. And so it is a good, because people are very invested in it, it's a very good example of how the wokeness or how certain groups of people might use some of the ideas around wokeness to sort of say, well, orcs are racist, or drools or drows, the dark elves who, you know, they're evil. So is this problematic or not? If you think it's racist, then you're not racist. If you think it's not racist, then you are racist. And if you disagree with us, then we're going to kind of beat you to the curb. So yeah, I mean, I think I reached out to a Bungacast listener who is much more familiar with these things than and their perspective was that that D&D still has the ability, because it is, you don't have a board in the traditional sense. It's not like a computer game. It's very, very open. You can, you know, if you're so inclined, you can play with some of these tropes. You can have an evil coded dark elf character who heads up an exploitative slave trade but also runs an orphanage with her disabled wife, or you can have a savage orc barbarian who also creates art and supports collectivizing all the land he conquers. So you can have some sort of fun with it, but this requires, I guess, you to feel confident with all the people that you're playing that you're not going to be judged. And this person did have to leave a game that they were playing because one of the other people playing it bought a copy of Mein Kampf to the to one of the sessions. So I don't know. I don't know what that. I mean, even if you're reading that book, you know, you don't have to make a point of putting it.
You should certainly not performatively.
I guess that's another thing. Like these kind of online, or not online, but and I guess all subcultures are mediated by through the internet nowadays. There's an element of edgelordism as well. So you can always factor that in. But yeah, it's a long and detailed article. So thanks, Anders, for sending this in. And we will link to it in the show notes.
Okay, so moving through letters to the editors from the most recent to the oldest. On this latest episode, which we've already made reference to with James Pogue, Heritage America versus the World, Tennis says, Garrison Keillor was the host of a popular public radio show, A Prairie Home Companion. Part of the show featured stories from a fictional Midwest town. APHC, A Prairie Home Companion fans, tended to be wealthier, educated, and proud of their Midwest roots. I'd say that these were the rural manifestation of the 20th century American liberalism globalism, an intense love of the local, but with buy-in and integration into the idea of an American universalism. Their disappearance is a symptom of the breakdown of the 20th century consensus. LES says, oh my God, this makes MAGA sound like a land back movement for white rural Americans. This explains so much. Yeah, basically, I agree with that. That's, I mean, you know, kind of that sort of nativist identitarian. That's where you're going to end up.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with Garrison Keillor. So thank you for America explaining it, Tennis.
Yanksplaining, yeah. Yeah, this is sometimes, I guess, what we do on this. Not us ourselves. We have other people come on to yanksplain to us and to you listeners, those, 65% of you who are not in the US. Right, episode 494, big episode with Wolfgang Strake back on the podcast, National Democracy or Globalist War. Damien Noah Neuhaus says, the after party was brilliant, a pithy summation of big ideas. Also interesting to hear more concretely where Lee stands politically. Lee, if you're listening to this, you need to manifest yourself. Where do you stand politically? We're going to put you up on the stand the next episode that you're on to explain where you stand. George, you weren't part of this episode, but...
You know, taking control co-author Lee Jones, I think, very ably represented, you know, one place you can stand politically that I think is a good place to stand these days. Yeah, I mean, a lot to say about this. I think Strake is one of the people, the thinkers I'll always read or listen to what he has to say, and went back to his 2014 How Will Capitalism End article, which is in New Left Review, and it's just spot on even still today. But yeah, what did I particularly take away from what he said? So this idea of this kind of dual crisis of capitalist growth that's trended down since the 80s and democracy as government is increasingly de-democratized, resulting in a deadlock struggle between globalists and populists. I think you and Lee were right to push him on whether the populists are really actually keen to take that kind of move downwards, as it were, to kind of re-situate politics in the nation state, because I think the left populists, as was proved, didn't want to, and the right populists seem to be very keen to evade this responsibility as well. I guess the main point of disagreement, or the thing that really got me thinking about this episode, was that Strake was clearly much keener on aspects of decentralization, or of pointing out the risks of over-centralized political processes, such as in the UK, where left behind regions are neglected by an over centralization in Westminster. And this is very different from what we argue in Taking Control, or some of the things that we argue in Taking Control, which is essentially that you need democratic power concentrated in the House of Commons. You make it more powerful in a number of different ways, such as increasing the number of MPs, but you want that centralization. You don't want devolution, pushing things to municipalities as a way to dilute that kind of democratic will. Yeah, I mean, a lot.
So you're Hamiltonians. You're progressive Hamiltonians, centralizers. Well, I mean, I am. I have no problem. I think all these kind of, you know, should be put firmly under the yoke of the democratic sovereign, you know?
Yeah, I haven't seen Hamilton, so I need to, maybe I need to reserve judgment.
I have not either, thankfully.
I wonder if it's actually way more, I'd be way more politically sympathetic if it was, you know, much more proto-chartist than I give Lin-Manuel Miranda credit for. True. But yeah, one thing that's maybe just, you know, because there's got a load more questions to get through, but you know, Strake mentions this Lenin idea of a pre-revolutionary situation where the rulers can't rule and the ruled don't want to be ruled. And I think that this kind of got me reflecting in a negative way about, yeah, that's true, but do the ruled want to rule themselves? Like, do we have a democratic ethos today? Do we have the kind of conditions of political subjectivity? Do we have that are we hungry for the power, as you might put it? And sorry, some listeners might get that rather obscure reference. And if we don't, then what do we need to do about it? Because like the worst position that you could ever find yourself in is like blaming the people for this revolution that should have happened and didn't happen. It's like, oh, let down again by those people. But yeah, I think the whole discussion, which I think was really excellent, does sound probably quite a cautious note that, you know, nation state democracy is possible but not probable. And maybe that's the best we're going to get at this point in time.
Yeah, no, that's very well put, George. I agree with that. And also similarly felt, you know, in faced with that quote from Lenin, that indeed the rulers do not want to rule, but it's unclear whether we want to rule ourselves or rather just want better rulers. And maybe we're still stuck in a situation where we want better rulers. You know, we want to be ruled better and are frustrated with that and are happy to kind of drop out for now. That situation may yet change, and we live in expectation and hope of that. To move on, 492, the armed wing of the deplatforming movement with Alex Gurevich, where we went through the situation on US campuses, what's going on with the surprising degree and intensity of censorship going on, particularly in relation to the Israel-Palestine question. So Eamon says, great discussion. The distinction Alex G. highlights between being versus feeling safe seems central to me, as it points to the crisis of legitimacy today. To assert whether or not someone is safe demands an agreed collective definition of safety and democratic mechanisms of determining whether this definition has been met. Both of these seem genuinely impossible in contemporary politics because legitimacy is decided through identitarian means, that is to say, who has the more authentic victimhood. This itself is entirely vibes-based. How can this be resolved, Eamon asks, how can this be resolved by the left without dissolving into apolitical or post-political gestures? I mean, I think that's
good. Question.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking like, oh, you know, because that question made me think, you know, do we ever have, you know, democratically agreed definitions of safety? Has that ever happened? What, you know, it's, no. But actually, if we think about the history of liberalism, which asserted, you know, the inviolability of the individual subject and that their freedom ends where, you know, harm is made on someone else. And it was quite clear what that meant. I guess that was a notion of harm, of safety, etc., which was very much modern. It was a post-Enlightenment conception, as opposed to the Ancien Régime conception, where you might have harm, which is like lèse majesté, for example, right? Where you could, you know, crimes against someone's honor, which are very, you know, kind of aristocratic conceptions. And that the more modern liberal bourgeois conception was far more robust and far more egalitarian in terms of, you know, what the rights everyone holds. And I guess this thing of feeling safe now and setting that as the standard by which, you know, degree acts can be limited would be as we've said before, you know, kind of very much undoes the gains of kind of liberal bourgeois society.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. I guess we are in this sort of situation of, aristocratic sort of society were vibes based, but a little, to a certain extent, like if somebody gave you bad vibes, you could demand satisfaction. You kind of slap them with your glove, have a duel, you know, you might die, but you know, better than being dishonored. And now we have the same sort of vibes based kind of, because we don't, it's not, safety isn't in terms of physical safety or safety of property. It is, yeah, maybe it is a pre-bourgeois kind of understanding where it is much more, not ephemeral, but there is, you know, it's not limited. And so you can have therefore, I guess it's quite conflictual, because it is like, if you damage my honor / feeling of safety, then I demand satisfaction and I will go to the state to achieve it or something like that. Whereas previously I might have done it directly. But yeah, I mean, and I think the wider point is that you have safety as a mechanism, as a basis for freedom.
It does remind me of Alistair McIntyre's comments and analysis and criticism of today's kind of soft subjectivism, where we don't have moral standards which we can agree upon, and everyone devolves into this soft subjectivism, which is basically says that, you know, you're, what you think is moral is kind of more or less whatever you say it is, with some hard limits, like you don't want to do the Holocaust again. Everyone agrees that's bad. But beyond that, we can't really have commonly shared moral standards because we've forgotten what morality is meant to be. And then he brings in this whole Aristotelian thing. Incidentally, something we should do on this podcast at some point, especially perhaps in honor of Alistair McIntyre, RIP, died recently. Anyway, one other question on this episode with Alex Gurevich. LES says, disappointing episode. It failed to get at the real political question. Why have the broad left and the broad right politicized this issue, Palestine effectively, of campus protest in terms of speech, harm, victimhood, and other psychic, purely symbolic matters rather than the more obvious material manifestations? Ellie goes on to say what those might be. There were months of protests in which plenty of strictly physical crimes occurred, property damage, building occupations, restrictions on individuals' freedom of movement, assault, and even manslaughter, murder in a couple of cases. You can see where the campuses and the protesters might want to brush those under the rug, but why do the anti-Semitism organizations, right, so these are kind of the pro-Israel Zionist guys, and the Trump administration, why do they participate so enthusiastically in brushing these things under the rug? What does it say about a regime of civil rights that a right to insulation from psychic damage and ideological contestation is now acted upon over and above the right, you know, not to be harmed physically? And he gives the example of being held captive in your workplace by its quote-unquote customers. So here, a specific case where the students who occupied a hall in Columbia University held the janitor inside it. Or indeed, the right not to be brained with a flagpole to death, which was a manslaughter case at UCLA. So again, they cared more about these like psychic harms, feeling unsafe, etc., rather than the physical, real stuff, real crimes. Now, for asking a question, I'll answer a question for you. The authorities choose Israel-Palestine because Israel-Palestine is where the internal contradictions of wokeness come out and express themselves. It was always going to be impossible to cater to wokes on campus among students, faculty, and administrators without taking a side on Israel-Palestine. Wokeness or radical liberalism itself simply demands that those more oppressed have a right to authority over those less oppressed. And this is the important bit. The fight over which of Israel and Palestine take that role was never actually settled back in the 1960s and 70s. As an aside here, this is something that we discussed a while ago. I think it was an episode where Phil was on. And I think it was Phil who made the point more forcefully that Israel and Palestine is in part a fight over who the ultimate victim is. It's a fight over claiming the mantle of victimhood, which is why it has such a degenerate quality. So Ellie concludes is that what I think the more internationalized left broadly gets wrong about all this is viewing it as coming from outside the house with the neat left versus right division. No, this is woke Democrat on woke Democrat psychic violence. Interesting. And indeed, I think a point that I've made before is that the Israel-Palestine thing hasn't really polarized on the standard basis that the culture war has, because it divides the quote-unquote left, broadly speaking. That you have the more centrist elements being pro-Israel and the further left parts being pro-Palestine. So it doesn't split as neatly as questions over racism and policing did, for example. Now, episode 491, Squeeze Between Two Empires, our episode on Poland, belated episode on Poland with Maciej Slinder. Damien Noah Newhouse says, clearly you guys just had Nathan Sperber on and asked him to put on a Polish accent. Lol. The shameless scam aside, insightful episode. Useful to highlight the populist right's social policy. It's similar in Hungary, where certain family biopolitical policies prove very popular. For example, a large state grant for young people pledging to have at least 3 children, which need not be paid back once child number 3 has arrived. Needless to say, though, that the basic and growing rift between rich and poor remains untouched by such measures. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about the you know, the pronatalism versus antinatalism thing, and the whole concern, and indeed the questioning of whether it should be a concern that fertility rates are declining, is that it's something which is not very amenable to policy, right? And which is why the temptation for to find technical solutions, like why don't you just give people money for having kids, doesn't quite work.
Yeah, not really related to this, but the comment got me thinking. We watched Children of Men a few nights ago, and it stands up so well, the particular view of like implosion. And it should be called Children of Women, not Children of Men. And it should be,
You mean womb havers, not, I mean.
Sorry. Well, Children of People. I guess men is used in the kind of mankind way. Anyway, you've kind of disrupted me from my point. And I guess that it's like women are in this story, women are infertile, but, you know, it seems like there is more of a problem with contemporary men than women, or maybe equally. Anyway, just wanted to throw that in there.
Okay, moving towards the last set of questions, which relates to the last end of month episode we had, which was very popular, in fact, called Boomer Death Rattle, episode 489. Justin O'Connor says, another nuanced discussion of the PMC and so on, appreciated the episode, perhaps made easier because Philpott has now left the building. but you all are
he's gone to work in the fields.
He's gone to work in the fields. He's setting an example out there in the fields of academia. But you are all mango. That he's saying this to us. This is not a snide comment. You and your guests overwhelmingly in media, arts, academia, perhaps less so NGOs. You did an episode on Julien Banda, who was a really bit of a transitional figure. You might think about the Sartre and Merleau-Ponty in the 1945 Temps Modernes manifesto, where history has ended and begun again, and they were to be hunters after meaning. Or Perry Anderson's latest in the New Left Review or Monde Diplomatique on idea forces. Where do ideas come from? Or finally, the intellectual ferment of the end of the 19th century and beginning of 20th century in China, in which whole worlds were ending and beginning. If we send the mangoes and the PMCs to the field, where will these ideas come from? I would also say, in relation to a comment read out here on the decline of the PMC as a harbinger of a long-term collapse of some kind of state project, this needs to be taken very seriously, and it's definitely not just Bismarck. The PMC could not be dismissed as virtue holders and are more than just managerial control agents. They are part of what modernity became. This is clear from the ways in which the new class PMC were identified as intrinsic to this kind of modernity. The debate was already there in the workers' movement at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, the account of bureaucracy and the domination of intellectuals. I'm just saying that the specific cultural turn since the 1960s, I do believe, has a deeper root than the quote-unquote artistic critique of capitalism, which Boltanski and Capello write about. It's something profoundly linked to ideas of modernity and not just some woke culturalism, which finally got its comeuppance. So as a way of kind of summarizing that, I think we need to distinguish the terms. And in fact, me saying mangoes is in part an attempt to do that. We also need to distinguish intellectuals or the intelligentsia, which themselves are distinct from one another, from the PMC as a whole and from mangoes. These are all distinct things, because, you know, I think we can say, well, do we need intellectuals? Yes. I think absolutely.
Well, we will have intellectuals, like, you know, it depends who you follow on this, but I tend to think Gramsci was right. You know, any mode of production will have its intellectuals.
Exactly.
People who are relatively more specialized in that aspect of production. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right to say that. I mean, and you're right to put it as an is rather than an ought. You know, we will have intellectuals. Now, the question of the PMC is different, and the question of the PMC's wokeness is itself a different iteration on this. So, I mean, with all those distinctions in mind, can't answer all of this in one go. We're going to be dealing with one aspect of this, which is to say the problem of the middle class in the next section of the Reading Club coming up starting in July. So please do join us for that as we try to get beyond just kind of throwing the term PMC around. Anyway, Ed F. says, thanks all. I enjoyed this conversation. I agreed with George's comments about the defining feature of wokeness, but I'd add authenticity as a central theme. The idea of a true inner self that's constantly being oppressed by the distorting, alienating, and corrupting influence of prevailing social norms and conventions makes sense of a lot of the preoccupations of identity politics. For example, the idea that your gender is ultimately what feels right to you inside, rather than the gender assigned to you at birth. The obsession with the trauma inflicted on marginalized people through the colonization of their subjectivity by social structures of patriarchy and racism. The insistence that white people are also harmed by their internalization of the dominant ideology of whiteness and must, quote-unquote, do the work to liberate themselves. And that men have to unlearn the toxic masculinity they've absorbed from society to realize their true authentic selves. This idea of a true inner self oppressed by society was also central to the 60s counterculture, and so the current backlash against wokeness is also, to an extent, a rejection of this aspect of the 60s. So I also think there's something in Alex's thesis. Damn right there is.
I think it's a really interesting point, the idea that the kind of a Rousseauian idea of the authentic self, which is then corrupted by society, and you can kind of, it's maybe this is kind of what it is. It's like a focus on authenticity without alienation, because you don't have a kind of economic critique. Instead, it's just, here are the distortions of kind of, you know, bad society and bad other people.
But I mean, isn't it, I don't think it's just individual versus society. It's about, I mean, it's a restatement here, a restatement of culture of narcissism, right? I mean, that's, to a certain extent, Lash in 1977 already kind of answered this question. Yes, of course, that the question of authenticity, the self is, you know, and that making that a primary public concern is really at issue. We were more comfortable previously wearing masks and understood that to go out in public, you wore a mask. You didn't need to show yourself. You didn't need to show your cards. JK says, I have to say, I think George completely dodged my point about engineering by claiming it was about reducing rather than increasing. Just to recap that, I think George made a point, if you remember, that engineer, you know, that talking about professionals or managers, or professional managerial class, that engineers are a different category because they're involved in producing, in increasing output, and that's where their specialty and their expertise lies, which is different from someone working in an NGO or a journalist or whatever. But JK takes issue with this. The Fordist engineers certainly said they could increase production, but inversely, they claim they could reduce average production costs. The point here isn't about increasing or decreasing, it's about optimization. Experts suggest that they can optimize something in favor of a commonly understood good. Whether it goes up or down is more to do with the specifics of the issue at hand. But the commonality is that experts, whether they be engineers, COVID experts, or trans experts, is that they are optimizing something. That is what matters. They are claiming expertise in driving numbers one way or another. What those numbers are is irrelevant. George.
Yeah, I can see where JK is coming from. I do think, though, to go back to Eamon's earlier point about things being more vibes-based, it does seem to me that there is some difference between an engineer and a contemporary COVID or trans expert, because in the case of production, it is, I guess, fewer inputs or more outputs. You can increase efficiency in either way or both. But I just don't think that there's that kind of commonly accepted framework of, you know, production that you have around, say, for example, COVID. There's just inherently more trade-offs involved. And so you can't fully quantify everything in the way that you can if you're just producing coats from how many, you know, yards of linen or whatever it would be. But maybe this is something which, you know, I need to think on a little bit more, or the contemporary kind of material bases of expertise. Like maybe this is kind of what I'm saying, that previously you had like the production experts who were the engineers, then like the life experts who was the church. And is there anything, you know, now there's the life experts are a bit of a wider group. That's just off the top of my head. You're looking
I think you're right. You're onto something, because it's to a certain extent about the process and the progress, the advance, put it that way, the advance of rationalization, right? So production gets rationalized first and foremost. You know, you have like Taylorism and then Fordism. These are forms of rationalize, which are use expertise, right? The expertise of management, right? How to manage people. Increasingly, expertise enters into other social realms, which is itself a reflection of total subsumption, of total capitalism, where, you know, other areas of life, which were previously kind of left to their own devices, become subject to a form of rationalization and therefore can be optimized, right? You can optimize your dating, you can optimize your health and your, you know, your habits and your nutrition, you know, you can optimize your mental health. So the most intimate things to us now are objects of rationalization. And indeed, something in between that, perhaps parenting and how to raise a family, has been the object of rationalization, you know, since the early 20th century, and increasingly so. So, you know.
Yeah, maybe that is it, just that rationalization, if Faber was right, that dialectic does spread into more and more aspects of life. And that's going to have a double-edged sword be a double-edged sword for people who purport to be experts, because ultimately, how can you, like the happiness industry, when we did a episode with William Davis a long while ago and talking about these sorts of things, like how can you maximize happiness? If happiness is the goal of life, how do you actually how do you optimize this? It's not like you produce more cans of Coca-Cola. It is something different. So maybe there's something in that.
Well, we hope that at least insofar as our guys as podcasters, that we've been able to optimize your, if not happiness, at least to a certain extent, comprehension or analysis of the world or something. Maybe
you'll be 5% more bunga after listening to this episode.
Well, exactly.
That is a guarantee. All your money back.
Excellent. We will leave that there. Thank you, listener, as always, for all your questions and comments. Apologies if we didn't get to yours. Let us know next time. We look forward to doing this in a month's time. Catch you then. Bye.